Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. This is what's happening in California over the next couple of days.
A lot of heavy rain, a lot of flash flood potential, totals of anywhere from 5 to 10 inches along the coastal ranges.
National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovec, as an atmospheric river moves in, flood and high wind alerts are up around the state. CBS Los Angeles reporter Rick Montanez is in Ventura County, which is expected to get some of the worst.
People who live in areas prone to flooding are out gathering sandbags to place around their property. Areas in the metro Los Angeles area are expected to get hit hard as well. Cities and counties across Southern California are preparing for potential disaster, and the governor's office of emergency services has placed swift water rescue teams with crews in Orange and Riverside counties.
We're learning more about the Houthi targets hit by a U.S.-British-led coalition inside Yemen. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on CBS's Face the Nation.
They were ammunition depots and command and control centers. They were the instruments that Iranian-backed Shia militia groups were using to attack American forces.
Correspondent Holly Williams is in Erbil, Iraq.
Iran called America's response a, quote, strategic mistake. But the big question now is really whether the militia groups that Iran backs will ratchet things up even further or instead try to de-escalate.
Senate negotiators have come up with a bipartisan deal they say will help ease the crisis at the southern border, while the House moves closer to impeaching the head of Homeland Security over the issue. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries tells ABC's This Week it's politics as usual.
What does impeaching Secretary Mayorkas have to do with fixing the challenges at the border? The answer is absolutely nothing. This is a partisan political stunt, and it should be abandoned by my Republican colleagues.
A full House vote is expected soon in central Chile. Firefighters having a tough time reaching areas hit by forest fires. The president says at least 1,100 homes are gone, at least 64 people killed. He expects those numbers to rise. Well, the music industry will honor its best tonight.
Will Miley Cyrus be the sleeper win of the Grammys tonight?
I can buy myself flowers.
Music insiders think she's a shoo-in for Album of the Year. The 66th Annual Grammy Awards will be hosted by comedian Trevor Noah. Lenny Kravitz and Ice Spice will be making appearances. You'll see performances by SZA, Dua Lipa, and Luke Combs with a special number by icon Joni Mitchell. The Grammys airs tonight on CBS and Paramount Plus. Cooper Lawrence, CBS News.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 7 on the Talk of Eau Claire, 93.5 The Tap, and on the Civic Media app.
Artificial intelligence could be used to meddle in this year's elections. As Eric Tegedoff reports, it could cause voters to mistrust all information, even the truth.
Before the New Hampshire primary, a robocall imitating President Joe Biden called voters and told them not to vote. It's seen as a potential preview of what voters could be in for as the 2024 general election approaches. Rachel Ori is the senior associate director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project. She says AI could have other consequences.
Our bigger concern is what's known as a liar's dividend, that the presence of false information makes voters trust any information less.
Ori says the past few years have seen a near constant assault on accurate voting information, which has made it challenging for good information to reach voters. Ori says AI could supercharge the misinformation campaigns that have existed for years. However, election officials across the country have a leg up going into the 2024 vote.
Election officials and voting advocates around the country are sort of well prepared to mitigate and respond to increases in misinformation because they've spent the last couple of years flexing that muscle and learning how to respond to misinformation and election denial campaigns.
Ori says election officials should have a plan ready to respond to AI misinformation campaigns. She says there likely aren't any regulatory options available at the moment to stop these operations.
Technology is maybe growing faster than the regulatory tools we have available. So at present, it seems difficult to find a policy that the government could adopt and make these robocalls impossible.
Ori says another concern is targeted campaigns that use a voter's personal information to persuade them not to vote, although there aren't any documented instances of this happening yet. I'm Eric Tegedoff. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some fog and some clouds to begin your day. Eventually, skies turning partly cloudy. Our highs reaching the upper 40s. In the overnight, upper 20s and mostly clear skies. On Monday, we'll see more clouds on the way. Upper 40s in the late afternoon. Right now, it's 48.
Local talk about our hometown and all of Wisconsin has gone untapped until now. You're on 93.5 The Tap. Make sure and tell your friends.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK. Weekday afternoons
from 4 until 6. Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
It is Saturday, February 3rd, 2024, and yes, my name is Jim Santel. I am going to be your host this hour and next hour as well on our Saturday morning broadcast. I am delighted. I am excited to have you with me this morning. We've got a lot of things to cover this morning, as we always do on our Saturday morning broadcast. I'm delighted not only to have you as a part of our listening audience, but also to have me in the studio with my good colleague and friend, Johnny, who's going to be supporting and assisting me today as my producer. As always, this is our morning review, our analysis, our discussion of some of the most significant and impactful news events, developments in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. And again, I invite your involvement in our discussion this morning. Johnny and I will be taking your phone calls at that number. It's 844-967-2789. One more time, that's 844-967-2789. Or as Johnny and Anya always remind me, you can also go online, Civic Media Stations, find your particular broadcast station, find the folder for our Saturday morning broadcast, and write to us electronically. We'll be able to take those notes and comments as well. As always this morning, as we get into our ambitious but achievable syllabus, we've got three principal questions. They include, what happened? What happened in the past week? What happened the past days? What happened the past month or so? What do we know? What are the facts of things that are out there? Why are those things important? Why are they significant or material or relevant to the world in which we live? And what, if anything, can we, should we be doing about those things, our actions, our responses, our answers to some of those principal questions about what happened and why are they important? Today, as always, a syllabus that includes an awful lot of things in the area of civics and government and law and the aspiration of justice in America, including as we start out, some analysis of something that a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America wrote late night, one of the nights of this past week, in connection with our judicial system. We're going to take a look at that, parse through that through a rule of law, justice, and court-related lens, try to figure out what exactly is credible, what is not credible in the statement placed on social media this past week about a recent piece of litigation in the civil courts of America. We're going to talk about that, analyze that as a way of getting us all into the aspect, into the subject matter of civics this morning. Beyond that, then, we're going to talk about what just happened yesterday, which is the certain postponement of this major, major trial being brought by the Department of Justice and the special counsel, his name, Jack Smith, pending right now before a district court judge, Tanya Chutkan. She announced a major decision last night about the scheduling of that, not at all surprising given what's happened. We'll talk about the reasons for that, what she said, what she didn't say at the time of her decision about scheduling, and how that's going to impact not only that particular trial. But what's going to be coming up in 2024 generally as we go into and continue to be into our election year? Then beyond that, we're going to spend a lot of time this morning, as we often do, focusing upon the United States Supreme Court more and more as we recognize the United States Supreme Court in our contemporary times, taking on issues that historically in our nation have been the purview of our legislature, our executive branch. Now, more and more, we've got courts, including our United States Supreme Court, deciding many issues that have a direct and important impact upon our lives. We're going to talk about some of those cases, including, yes, indeed, the upcoming campaign and whether or not one of those same candidates who's writing on social media just this past week, whether he can appear on a ballot, on a Republican primary ballot in the state of Colorado. You know what that's all about. We're going to talk about what's going to be happening next week. So bring out your calendars, bring out your pens so you can mark next Thursday, February 8th, for an important event happening before the United States Supreme Court in that important case called Trump versus Anderson. The entire month of February is going to be a big month for oral arguments, cases pending before the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about what the docket looks like right now, and then talk about two other sets of cases that are also going to be the focus of the Supreme Court's attention in this, the month of February 2024. We're going to talk about two major cases having to do with the internet and social media, the interaction between all of that and government, and what you can expect in terms of decision-making coming out of those cases. It's going to affect, going to have a tremendous impact upon how we understand the relationship between government and postings on social media, the internet generally. We'll talk about those two cases as we have done before. They're coming up for oral argument as well. And we're going to finally talk about a case at the end of this month, likewise coming up, having to do with guns in America. We have chatted a lot on this broadcast about this whole series of cases pending in front of the United States Supreme Court affecting Second Amendment issues, gun issues, firearms issues in America. This one having to do with bump stocks. Oral argument about the legitimacy, the capacity of the federal government to restrict bump stocks as we go forward. We're going to chat about that this morning as well. Then we're going to talk about something that happened in the past. You may recall well, you will recall well, that in June, late June of last year, the United States Supreme Court in this major case found for the first time in decades that it is impermissible, constitutionally impermissible, for colleges, both private and public, to address issues of race when it comes to deciding who is going to be in their incoming classes. Major case of last term in June of last year, and having implications, as we predicted then, on what's going on today in our universities, both public and private, throughout the United States of America. I'm going to give you some sense of some anecdotal support for the results of that major decision. I'm going to talk about what it is that students are doing today and how it is that even guidance counselors and teachers are recommending that students put together their applications in the wake of that major case involving Harvard and also involving UNC, but actually involving all colleges and universities in our land. Many months after that decision, what is the impact? What's going on today in February of 2024, impacted so dramatically by what the Supreme Court decided way back in the summer of last year? Then we're also going to spend some time talking about immigration, this notion that James Madison, George Mason, others established would be the exclusive purview of the federal government in our Constitution. I'm going to talk about the war, if you will, with a small w, the battle, the legal battle, and the procedural, a practical battle right now going on between the executive branch and the Biden administration, the Biden White House, and Governor Greg Abbott in Texas. It is manifesting itself in two very significant ways. I'm going to talk about something that happened just about 2 weeks ago, again, coming out of the Supreme Court. And then we're also going to chat in that connection with the Department of Justice also discussing in the courts what it is that the state of Texas can and cannot do when it comes to the enforcement of immigration policies and practices. The Department of Justice taking on the state of Texas and some legislation passed by its legislature, signed by its governor, that intrudes upon the exclusive purview of the federal government to administer, to oversee immigration issues in this land. We're going to talk about that and what the United States Department of Justice, through Merrick Garland and other offices there, is doing to address those immigration matters involving not only law enforcement, but also, yes, something as practical as barbed wire. Barbed wire along our southwest border. Then we're going to chat in our second hour and probably beyond into the next broadcast next Saturday as well. But a number of things happening in our courts beyond those major issues pending before the Supreme Court that affect our Constitution. I'm going to talk about a recent sentencing of an individual formerly of the executive branch sentenced to some time in prison for his failure to abide by a congressional subpoena. I'm going to talk about a major, major sentencing of just this past week of a defendant formerly employed by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, compromising our national security, our nation's secrets. I'm going to talk about the circumstances that brought him into federal court and the consequences of his actions resulting in a 40-year, that's right, a 40-year penalty sentence imposed upon him. And then, finally, in connection with things going on in America, changes in the ways in which we think about the impact not only of civil but also criminal prosecution, we're going to talk about this case in Michigan. This case involving the parents of a young man who engaged in a mass shooting. We'll talk to you about, once again, the circumstances of that and the decision by a prosecutor there in the state of Michigan to sue, to criminally charge the parents for involvement in and support of those actions, those horrific, catastrophic actions by their son. I'm going to chat about the pendency of that case and what's going to be happening probably in this coming week. This coming week, again, not only important for the Supreme Court cases, but also a lot of things going on in courts around America. Highly likely, although we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it this morning, that sometime next week, the sitting judge overseeing this major case involving valuations by Donald Trump, this case brought by the Attorney General of the state of New York, Letitia James, against Donald Trump, his sons, and the organization, this case that took weeks to try, now pending before Judge Arthur Engoron, and the likelihood that sometime soon, maybe even this coming week, he is going to issue his written opinion deciding how much Donald Trump and the affiliated defendants are obliged to pay to the state of New York. Anticipate that order perhaps coming out as soon as this coming week. Certainly very soon, the judge there has promised, has committed to the parties. He's going to get his order out sometime. He said initially in late January, in early February. That is this time. And so next week could be a hugely important time, not only for decisions, but also things going on in the courts of America. And so let's begin. Let's begin our road, our focus this morning on civics. And as I said, a little bit different start today. We recall from our previous discussions, you know well from your own digesting news reporting and other kinds of media out there, that E. Jean Carroll, in a series of lawsuits, civil lawsuits in the federal district court, was successful in bringing a case alleging defamation against the former president. Some of that involved in statements he made even while he was the president of the United States of America, resulting recently in an $83 million judgment against him. When we come back after this break, I'm going to talk with you about Donald Trump's posted reaction to that. We're going to analyze that, pull that apart, figure out what he says that's legitimate, if anything, what he says is illegitimate about the way that courts work, about civics in America and our understanding of the administration of justice. Stay with us for that continuing discussion here on our Saturday morning broadcast, the studios and the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
The Tap.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back in our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining me on this Saturday morning, February 3rd, 2024. I am your host this hour and next hour. My name is Jim Santel. As promised, we're going to begin our substantive discussion this morning by taking a look at a civic statement, some civics propositions offered by a gentleman, a man who is right now running for the presidency of the United States of America, who also found himself recently on the receiving end of a very significant, a huge monetary judgment, a case brought by E. Jean Carroll, her attorneys, finding that in the end, Donald Trump not only defamed her, a finding made in a previous trial, but also now that he is obliged to pay her $83.3 million, that including a package of both compensatory damages and punitive damages altogether, the lion's share of that punitive or punishment portions of that judgment. That judgment entered just recently. In the wake of that, obviously, statements by all the parties about the legitimacy and the illegitimacy, at least if you're Donald Trump, about that jury verdict. And in fact, just this past week, Donald Trump, on his own social media outlet, said this. We're going to read through the entire posting first. I'm going to spend some time getting some understanding about what he says, most of which reflects a complete misunderstanding about civics in America, about how courts work, about what judges do, about what juries do, about what evidence is all about, what pretrial motions are all about. All of that reflecting on Donald Trump's understanding of what goes on in courts, and in particular, of course, a message sent not to the people who understand what courts are all about, but to those people who might be beguiled into believing that what he is saying is true. This is what he wrote at 11:08 in the evening on January 30th of 2024. He said this, again, coming in the wake of this unfavorable decision entered against him by a trial jury in the Manhattan federal court. He said this. He said, I am in the process, along with my team, of interviewing various law firms to represent me in, and again, the focus on that, representing me in an appeal, capital A, of one of the most ridiculous and unfair witch hunts our country has ever seen. Witch hunts, all of that capitalized. Our country also capitalized. He says the defamation sham presided over by a Clinton-appointed, highly partisan, Trump-hating judge, Lewis Kaplan, who was, together with certain other radical left Democrat judges, one of the most partisan and out-of-control activists that I have ever appeared before. All this coming from Donald Trump at 11:08 on January 30th of 2024. Describes the judge, Lewis Kaplan, as a bully who demanded two trials rather than one, denied me due process, would not allow me to put forth vital evidence, in parentheses, of which there was much, and only allowed me to be on the witness stand for minutes, telling my lawyer what to ask and telling me to only give one-word answers as his wife, that is presumably the wife of the judge, Lewis Kaplan, and friends sat in cordoned off front row seats watching with glee. Then begins to summarize this overlong tirade about justice in America by saying, this entire hoax, all capital letters, is a disgrace to our American system of justice. And it says this, any lawyer who takes a Trump case is either crazy, capitalized and also in quotes, or a Trump American patriot, all of that capitalized. I will make my decision soon. Now, why am I articulating that for you? We don't normally spend a lot of time focusing on these kinds of rants in America, but it struck me as I read this, not at 11:09 on January 30th, but afterwards, that's a perfect a way of understanding how it is that courts in America work and how it is that they do not, reflecting along the way the failure of this particular individual, a litigant in this civil case, and also someone who's running to be the president of the United States of America, reflects his basic misunderstanding of how things work. Let's go back and work through all of the things that he says. Now, he does indeed have an absolute right to appeal that decision. He will take that up. If he does, in fact, identify the firm, as he said, who wants to do that on his behalf, he can also represent himself if he wanted to in America. That's a good thing about our courts, both in federal and state courts. If you want to, you can represent yourself. Probably not a good idea, given the intricacies and the complexities of appellate proceedings in the federal circuit courts in the Second Circuit. And that's the circuit out there in New York to which he would appeal this decision entered by a jury, by the judge, based upon that jury verdict, goes to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, interviewing now law firms who may do that. And again, he's got that right to do that. That's probably one of the few things in this entire post that he gets right. And then goes on to say that this is an unfair witch hunt, one of the major, most ridiculous unfair witch hunts that our country has ever seen. Let's talk about that witch hunt aspect. Let's talk about where this case came from. Well, lawyers, whenever they present cases like this in the civil system, unlike the criminal system, in the civil system, have this absolute obligation to put forth in a civil complaint the basis for their complaint, their charges, their allegations against an identified defendant. Now, criminal prosecutors also have that obligation, of course, but for the most part, they are relied, at least in the federal system, on grand juries that review those kinds of things. Here you've got a civil litigant, E. Jean Carroll, through her attorneys, who put together this civil claim. They have an ethical obligation, all attorneys do, to put things in a complaint upon which they believe the evidence will show, provide a basis for it by a preponderance of the evidence. Not to say that all those things come true, but if indeed you put together a complaint, make allegations against anyone, any person that are completely unfounded, as we have seen recently, lawyers will get in trouble for that. They will lose their license. They will be suspended. They will be prohibited from trying cases in the future. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why this is not a witch hunt. This is the premise for a complaint. Donald Trump had the obligation and did indeed respond to that. And the witch hunt that Donald Trump describes here was followed with a trial, as we know now, that resulted in this $83.3 million judgment. The defamation sham, he said, presided over by a Clinton-appointed, highly partisan, Trump-hating judge, Lewis Kaplan. Now, that's true. There is a federal judge named Lewis Kaplan. Plainly, he would reject, as I would, this notion that somehow his partisan background, the fact that he was appointed by a president named Bill Clinton, had an impact upon the litigation, his oversight of the jury review of this case. Nonetheless, allegations of bias by this particular litigant against Lewis Kaplan. And then goes on to note that there were certain other radical left Democrat judges. Not entirely clear what that means. Of course, there's only one judge presiding over this case. His name is Lewis Kaplan. And he is responsible, of course, for determining the course of conduct. It all goes back to this fundamental notion about the process. After that complaint is filed, after an answer is submitted, the judge, through his systems of court administration, then responsible for overseeing things like pretrial motions and the conduct of discovery. If parties have disputes about the production of evidence and witnesses, those kinds of things, they can go to the judge. And again, not in the context of a witch hunt, but the judge then reviews those things, takes information, takes argument, takes evidence from both sides in resolving all of those kinds of situations coming up before him in this case. That's what Lewis Kaplan did, not reflecting the kind of highly partisan, Trump-hating perspective that Donald Trump describes in this post. When we come back, I'm going to go through the second portion of this post and again describe along the way why it is that Donald Trump gets this so wrong, and also by virtue of his misstatements, making us clear on how things do in fact work and did in fact work in this case recently in the federal court in New York. Stay with us for that discussion.
Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the Valley and all of Wisconsin.
In fact, it's on tap every day. This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Flood and high wind alerts are up for much of California as an atmospheric river moves in with heavy rain. National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovec.
As it moves right towards the coast, there'll be some really high winds, especially as you get up in some of the higher elevations along the coast. So the winds will be gusting over 50, 60 miles per hour.
A day after airstrikes on Houthi targets in Syria and Iraq, one-time Central Command head General Frank McKenzie tells Face the Nation the Houthis' backers should be kept off balance.
I am not advocating for striking Iran. I am advocating that they need to be in the space of possible targets so that they're held at risk.
Arizona independent Kyrsten Sinema has helped negotiate a bipartisan Senate immigration deal. She tells Face the Nation it's a long-term solution.
These are powerful new tools that allow any administration, this one and future administrations, to actually gain control of the border.
CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
The Packers hire a new coordinator. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Green Bay Packers hired a new defensive coordinator this past week after Joe Barry was fired following three seasons with the team. Jeff Hafley is 44 years old and takes over after 4 years as the head coach at Boston College, and was asked what's the first thing he taught his players.
That's a great question. I felt the biggest thing for me was at the time talking to the players, I wanted to bring some confidence to them and I wanted them to enjoy the game. It's a game. You got to enjoy it. You got to enjoy practice. You got to play with confidence. I don't want guys playing scared. I didn't want them playing tentative because they were afraid to make mistakes. I didn't want coaches just like, what always bothered me was, you know, a DB gets beat on a goal ball and you start yelling and screaming out, go coach him. Tell him why. Ask him what he saw. Yeah. Ask him about his first step. Yeah. Ask him what he did at the top of the route, what the split was, and then tell him what he should do better.
That's the Packers' new defensive coordinator, Jeff Hafley. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some fog and some clouds to begin your day. Eventually, skies turning partly cloudy. Our highs reaching the upper 40s. In the overnight, upper 20s and mostly clear skies. On Monday, we'll see more clouds on the way. Upper 40s in the late afternoon. Right now, it's 48.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Outgoing Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. The way I joke about it is I'm probably not doing my job right if somebody's not ticked off at me most of the time.
The only way you can do it is if you have that steadfast commitment to doing justice. That tension's built into it, and that's quite frankly what makes the job just so phenomenal and exciting and fun.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Weeknights at 6 p.m.
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alma Show.
You look at Taylor Swift. She fought off the bitterness of defeat when she lost her records, when she was kind of duped by a manager. People who told her she'd never amount to anything. But it doesn't matter if you like her music or not. I'm a fan of anyone. Doesn't matter whether they're an artist or an athlete or just a common Jane or Joe. If you've overcome something in your life, you're a winner. If you've made it through, that's what it's all about.
The Todd Alma Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey.
morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining me this Saturday morning, February 3rd, 2024. We're beginning our discussion this morning by analyzing something that the former president, Donald Trump, president candidate for the White House once again, wrote just this past week in connection with his huge disappointment, an understatement by any measure, as a result of the $83.3 million judgment entered against him in the defamation lawsuit brought by E. Jean Carroll. Going through this, not only to understand why Donald Trump is so wrong on many of these things, but also exposing along the way some exposition about how things actually work in courts. And right before the break, talking about this notion that somehow this was a witch hunt. In fact, nothing of the sort. This is a process by which civil litigants, as I indicated before, bring cases into the federal and state courts of our land, file complaints, file answers, engage not in witch hunts, but attempts to discover the truth, which ultimately results in what? A jury trial, which is exactly what happened here. Along the way, Donald Trump on the 30th of January, 11:08 at night, writes as well that the presiding judge, Lewis Kaplan, describes him as highly partisan, plainly the product, as he says, of the person who appointed him, Bill Clinton, many, many years ago, says he's out of control. He's an activist, one of the most out-of-control activists that I've ever appeared before. And again, what is the role of a federal district court judge? It's not to litigate the case. Instead, it is to supervise and monitor all those things that Donald Trump now complains about, and here they are. He says the judge was a bully who demanded two trials. Let's talk about that for just a moment. No, in many cases in which there's a question of liability, there's also a question of damages. And pursuant to that fundamental understanding about the way that many, not all, but many cases proceed in our federal and state courts, the judge divided this case. Bifurcated is the word that lawyers love to use and the judges also invoke. Bifurcated broke this case into two different portions, and in particular said along the way that one of the things that he wanted to do was to ensure that there's an addressing of liability first, and then secondarily, along the way, if indeed liability was found, that then under appropriate circumstances, the jury would then go back and take a look at damages. This notion of bifurcation, not demanded by the judge, but an appropriate invocation of the process by which cases are tried in our state and federal courts. It is a matter of efficiency. It's a matter of productivity. It's a matter of focus to ensure that a jury has the relevant evidence in front of it. And if indeed there's not a finding of liability, here there plainly was, but if there isn't a finding of liability, you don't have to get to damages, right? And so that's the reason why his statement about demanding two trials, that coming from the judge purportedly, no demand was made. That's a part of the regular procedure. And then denying Donald Trump due process. The next thing he says, well, let's once again talk about that. Due process. What does that basically mean? It means notice. It means being told the kinds of things that the opposing side is telling you. An opportunity plainly to be heard in court. To confront witnesses, to confront those who might make allegations against you. All of that supremely upheld during the course of this months-long, actually years-long proceeding to ensure what? That in the end, justice is done. The entire jury process is an opportunity for both sides, litigants on both sides, to have people in a jury review the evidence that they are presenting in court. That's the ultimate due process. After, again, notice of the charges, an opportunity to be heard. Fundamentally, that also due process. And indeed, Donald Trump, through his lawyers and directly, given this amazing opportunity throughout this trial to do just that, not denied by this judge, but rather afforded by him a part of the due process, a part of this trial, and a part of any other trial going forward in America, would not allow me, he says, to put forth vital evidence of which there is much. Let's talk about that for just a moment or so. Again, plaintiff has an obligation, the burden of proof here, the preponderance of the evidence is the standard by which E. Jean Carroll had to establish, number one, liability that indeed this sexual assault did in fact take place in the mid-1990s in this department store in Manhattan. And then also a burden of proof, a burden by a preponderance about the amount of damages that E. Jean Carroll presented. She did that by virtue of witnesses, her own testimony, the testimony of other economists who talked about the damages that she suffered as a result of the defamation that was perpetrated by the defendant, Donald Trump. And then, indeed, he had the opportunity to present that evidence that he wanted to do. He made the selection through his attorney to testify, which he has, again, the right to do. And did, in fact, the judge limit appropriately the scope, the breadth of that testimony? Absolutely. Why? Because this case is all about damages. It is not a retrial of the underlying liability issue. That was found previously, the previous trial by another jury. And so, again, this judge, like any other judge, is going to limit by virtue of this focus on relevance, things that are material, things that are significant for the jury to understand. That's exactly what he did and said to Donald Trump and his attorneys, that when you take the stand, you need to talk about things that are relevant to what? To the damages issue. In the end, he did not do that. And the judge did indeed cut him off with respect to one of his answers when he felt he was going down the road that he is specifically prohibited to pursue. And that, again, is what judges do based upon the evidence code, based upon the status of the case, here focusing upon money damages. Donald Trump did not talk about money damages. He didn't talk about his own finances, his capacity to pay a particular amount of a judgment. He could have done that, should have done that. The judge permitted him some latitude. And in the end, his trial attorney decided to ask him just a handful of questions. Some of them focused, some of them not so focused, but that was the due process that Donald Trump, through his attorneys and directly on the stand, was given. What other evidence is out there? If Donald Trump had that evidence, had the obligation on his own behalf, as he said, on behalf of his behalf and behalf of his family and his corporation, to present that evidence. He says there are a huge amount of evidence out there. We don't know what that is. Only allowed me on the stand, witness stand, for a few minutes, telling my lawyer what to ask and telling me to only give one-word answers. Again, all of that a part of the judge's appropriate attempt with Donald Trump on the stand to make certain that the jury is hearing things that are relevant, that are not incendiary, that could not cause a mistrial, for example, not limiting the courtroom procedure in a way that would affect the due process being given to Donald Trump. In fact, just affording him precisely the opposite. And this particular judge, as we've talked about before, has given Donald Trump a huge amount of opportunity in this case to be heard and to be heard in the courtroom in front of this jury. Finally, this focus upon this case being a hoax, a disgrace to our American system of justice. Undeniably, this did not go well for Donald Trump. And he's got this huge judgment against him, not unusual for litigants, civil and criminal, who are on the receiving end of judgments with which they do not agree. Plainly, Donald Trump does not agree with this. He's going to take this up on appeal, presumably, if he gets that law firm, if he hires that law firm to do this on his behalf. But the reality is that this is not a hoax, because in the end, the single most important thing that undermines and discredits virtually everything that Donald Trump said about this bad civics lesson he was giving to America, meant to encourage people who do not understand the process, who would be beguiled by his statement. The ultimate thing to understand is this was a jury. The judge did not decide this. The lawyers did not decide this. The witnesses did not decide this. E. Jean Carroll did not decide this. A jury. Where did a jury come from? There are people who are produced from the area, from the community, in this case, from New York, brought in to hear the evidence and make a decision, to deliberate, and to come to a decision based upon the standard of proof. This is preponderance of evidence, basically 51%. That's what the judge instructed him to do. That's the due process afforded Donald Trump in this case, as he would be in any other case, and indeed will be by those other trial judges in the civil and criminal setting, which we have yet to hear from. Again, using Donald Trump's own words to underscore the lack of any understanding about the judicial process in America, but also to underscore the fact that indeed this process took years in the making, years of process, giving Donald Trump the due process that he deserves, that any litigant deserves, just the opposite of what Donald Trump wrote to us, wrote to America at the 11th hour of January 30th of 2024. Now, I mentioned already that there are other trials out there coming up. We know that there are at least four other criminal cases that are already in the docket. And let's talk about one of those that also was in the news just last night. One of those cases is pending in the federal district court in the District of Columbia. The E. Jean Carroll matter pending in the federal district court in Manhattan. That's the Southern District of New York. This case, this major case involving election interference, singular defendant, Donald Trump, four counts against him, all premised upon the January 6th events and things leading up to that, brought by the Department of Justice, brought by special counsel, the presiding judge, Tanya Chutkan, in connection with the due process in that case, this criminal case pending in the federal trial court in the District of Columbia, entertained an argument by Donald Trump as a part of the process by which she, like every other judge, like Judge Kaplan, her colleague in Manhattan, also entertained motions. And what did she do? She afforded Donald Trump the opportunity to attack the legitimacy of that prosecution. And in particular, through the motion filed by Donald Trump's attorney, she entertained this notion that a sitting president is immune from prosecution, has executive presidential immunity for all the things that he, perhaps one day she, does while in office. And she resolved that based upon oral argument, on written argument, and produced an opus, if you will, about the notion that our presidents are not kings, as she said, and determined through this very learned statement that she provided to the litigants, Donald Trump, and to the Department of Justice, that rejecting this notion that there is presidential immunity in any setting, including the one pending in front of her. Now, Donald Trump, again, pursuant to the due process afforded him in these trials, took this up to the D.C. Court of Appeals. And yes, indeed, the D.C. Court of Appeals has been reviewing Judge Chutkan's order for a whopping 25 days, coming up on almost 4 weeks now. It is getting a bit late. The United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia needs to resolve this matter, number one, because it's not a difficult issue to resolve, but second, because as we have talked before and we'll talk again this morning, it has an impact upon the timing of the case in front of Judge Chutkan. She had previously scheduled this case to begin in early March. Just yesterday, Judge Chutkan, based upon the fact that this matter is still pending before the D.C. Court of Appeals, entered a major order. She basically said that she is scrapping the March 4th trial date, and she said that she would set a new trial date for the proceeding in her court in Washington. These are her words, if and when Mr. Trump's immunity claims are resolved. Interesting that she says if, and adds onto that the notion of when. So expressing perhaps through a little bit of her own frustration that the appellate court is likewise not working with all deliberate speed to resolve this. We know as well that those immunity claims were in front of this three-judge panel of the D.C. Court of Appeals. They heard oral argument on January 9th. That's where we get the 25 days since that time. We talked a lot about what may happen this coming week. It is hoped, certainly, that sometime very soon, before a full month goes by, that the D.C. Court of Appeals issues its order in that case. And they should indeed and predictably will find that Judge Chutkan was proper in determining that there is no presidential immunity, that the case against Donald Trump on those four counts in the indictment against him in the federal district court can and should proceed. She is waiting for that. The District of Columbia Circuit Court needs to resolve this matter very soon because, of course, what is it doing? It's delaying the trial. And indeed, yesterday evening for the first time, we've got a clear statement from Tanya Chutkan about the impact upon of this plea, of this appeal, and the process by which this is going forward. Now, once again, does Donald Trump have a right to appeal this? Absolutely. That's what we anticipate in our courts. It is taking a long time. And now, out of some frustration, Tanya Chutkan says, I'm taking all this off my calendar. We will see if and when those immunity claims are resolved. And of course, what could happen next? Well, after the D.C. Court of Appeals, hopefully, presumably, very soon, decides to resolve that matter, Donald Trump could seek an appellate review, seek a writ of certiorari in front of the Supreme Court, and that would only further delay this matter as well. As we've talked before, the Supreme Court should decline to review this case and should, in fact, send it then back down to Judge Chutkan so that she can put this back on her trial calendar and get this underway. When we come back right after this break, talk about the consequences of her decision just yesterday to dropkick her March 4th trial date and presumably...
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back here on this, our final segment of our first hour here on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about things pending before the Supreme Court and also pending before the D.C. Court of Appeals. This issue identified by Tanya Chutkan as without merit, the issue being whether a president is immune from criminal prosecution, finding that indeed that doctrine does not apply. The D.C. Court of Appeals still has under advisement, still taking its time, if you will, to resolve that matter. If indeed the circuit court, as it should, affirms the lower court decision, Donald Trump, again, a part of the due process that he claims is being taken from him, at least in this other matter, part of that due process, he has a right to seek additional review by the United States Supreme Court of that D.C. Circuit Court decision. Now, the Supreme Court should, in an exercise of good discretion, decide not to do that and leave this alone, leave the law of the case as the D.C. Circuit presumably will decide it, as Judge Chutkan has decided. But if the United States Supreme Court decides to take that case on, then it would offer that the scheduling of the trial in this matter is truly, truly being delayed inordinately during this election year, during any time. Why? Because after the Supreme Court takes this case, it will once again, could even expedite the process, but still will solicit from the parties more briefs on this issue. Some more written things submitted not only by Jack Smith, but also by Donald Trump. Again, a part of the process that he would be afforded in the course of this litigation before the Supreme Court. And then presumably would schedule on oral argument. And that too would take some time. And then after that, the Supreme Court resolve this matter, hopefully finally finding that indeed there's no presidential immunity. But all of that would presumably add weeks, if not months, to this process. Now that's already been suspended by Judge Chutkan as of yesterday, finding that the pendency of all of this prevents her from going ahead and keeping that March 4th trial date on the calendar. As an important footnote to all of this, significant that among the four criminal cases, as you may well recall, the very first one charged was by the Manhattan District Attorney. His name again, Alvin Bragg. This is the hush money case involving Stormy Daniels, also involving, as we know well, the former fixer, if you will, Michael Cohen, the former lawyer for Donald Trump and his organization. That case pending before a justice, a judge named Juan Merchan, and he's going to be having a hearing on February 15th in the New York Manhattan State Court. That's a criminal case alleging, once again, violations of state law by the DA. And the district attorney there has said, well, gee, if the federal case doesn't go in early March, we can put this trial before a jury in this Manhattan case, courtroom as well, in front of Judge Merchan. The trial right now is scheduled to begin on March 25th. And indeed, it has also been slowly but surely moving forward. Again, the due process appropriately afforded Donald Trump. And indeed, there is good reporting that the Manhattan DA's office is approaching witnesses to prepare them for the proceeding. And that, of course, includes Michael Cohen in this process. Entirely possible that the first among the four major criminal cases, the other two out there, of course, the Georgia case and the Mar-a-Lago documents case, that the very first case going to trial could indeed be the first one that was charged way back when, about a year or so ago, alleging improprieties, violations, criminal violations of New York law That could go in front of Judge Merchan, who is, again, going to, in just a week or so, going to have a status conference to decide when indeed that case is going to be tried. Right now it's on his calendar for March 25th. That indeed could happen. All of this plainly interrelated. And once again, the reason why we spend time talking about it this morning is it refutes this notion that Donald Trump articulated, admittedly just in connection with the E. Jean Carroll matter, but that the judges are against him, the witnesses are against him, the evidence rules are against him, juries are against him, democratically appointed judges, judicial officers, all these people against him. It simply isn't true. The fact of the matter is that in all of these cases, he is being afforded the appropriate, arguably even more due process than other defendants in the civil and certainly a criminal arena might otherwise be afforded. As always, we appreciate your listening, but also appreciate your phone calls. And delighted this morning to have a couple of callers, some listeners calling in. Let's begin with Nick from Madison. Nick, your comment or question this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Hey, thank you for having me. Here's the thing. It's like, I'm a conservative, but I am not a Trump supporter, okay? Because everything you're saying about how he's basically being empirical,
right,
being an emperor.
As Judge Chutkan said, we have presidents, not kings. And again, to your good point, Nick, the notion that somehow he is being unfairly treated simply isn't true. But again, go ahead. Appreciate your comments here.
Absolutely. But here's the thing. I mean, it's not like this is a new thing. President Obama, who I didn't agree with, but I think he's a good guy, he said, direct quote, "I'm not going to wait for Congress. I have a pen and a phone." So this isn't new, is what I'm saying.
Sure. And again, I think you're right, Nick, that every single president has been frustrated by Congress, right? Democrats, Republicans, whether it's Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, candidly, Barack Obama, George Bush, everyone, Ronald Reagan, they've all been upset by the failure of Congress to act. And the thing that you're specifically talking about, I suspect, is in the area of immigration, where Barack Obama said he's waiting for immigration legislation to come forward and said, you know what, I've got this capacity to issue executive orders. And that's what he did. And that had to do with DACA and other related things. We know that remains in the courts. Why? Because people come forward as a part of our system and challenge that executive order. Again, that's what we embrace. That's what we should do here in America. But the reality is that...
And that's what I think, though, is that the failure of Congress to act, that's a feature. It's not a bug. We shouldn't just... Congress shouldn't just do things, okay? It should debate. It should get through things, and there is compromise involved.
Sure, absolutely.
Presidents don't like that.
Well, I think that I agree with you to the extent that Congress has this obligation to act. I would say that they should be doing things. And when we come back after this first break, we'll chat more about that particular obligation, I would say, to legislate in the areas of immigration and environment and even commerce and all the other things that are going on right now when presidents become frustrated by the failure of the Congress to do things after debate, and specifically with immigration has been pending for a very long time. That's when presidents begin to act on their own, maybe lawfully, maybe not. That's what the courts are also about. Nick, appreciate very much your comment this morning, and we will continue to entertain those kinds of good civics observations and questions about our history as we go.
Tell a friend what's on tap.
There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Hey, everybody, this is Aaron from The Todd Allbaugh Show. Just letting you know that Todd will be back on Monday with a brand new show. So tune in then from noon to 2.
My name is Juanita Segura, and I was diagnosed in November of 2014 with non-small cell lung cancer. Biomarker testing was a turning point for me. By working with my oncologist, we were able to determine the most appropriate treatment plan. My fear was I wasn't going to be here to see my children grow up. That gave me hope, knowing that I have that chance, and I did. Visit noonemissed.org for more.
A public service message from Longevity Foundation.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.